Access number 30416, Mr. John Taylor, Reel 9. Now, we're just going through the raid before D-Day, and another thing you seem to have done, the 24th of May, was you raided the Philips Electronics factory at Eindhoven in Holland. And after the war, you found something out about that raid and the Dutch resistance. Do you remember that? Or is that gone?
That's probably gone.
It's about them evacuating the factory after.
Yes. I think that somehow they'd got word to the resistance that we were coming. And they'd got word to their workers to evacuate the factory. So although we bombed the factory very completely, there were very few Dutch casualties. And that was nice, because whenever we bombed over France or Holland, you were always very aware you were killing civilians as well.
How did you feel generally about civilian casualties? I mean, even German, I mean, later on, or when you did the factories in the Ruhr, what was your attitude to civilian casualties? Because, I mean, well, bomber command can get criticised for it, but it's actually not anyone's fault. But can you comment on it?
Well, the brashness of youth. We didn't think too much about the Germans, because they'd supported Hitler, they'd caused the war, they bombed, supported the bombing of our country that occupied Europe. So, right, they were part of the enemy as well. Civilian or not, they were all part of the enemy. This is, we thought our civilians were all part of the war effort. But we did worry about killing Frenchmen and Dutchmen.
Now, the next big thing is on the evening, is that this raid on naval guns at Pierre Lamont at Cherbourg.
Yes.
Now, this is part of D-Day in many ways.
They didn't tell us at the briefing it was part of D-Day, but we got a pretty good idea by the time the briefing was over, because they told us there'll be American and British warships in the channel. Keep well clear of them. Keep to your course, because they will fire whether you've got IFF on or not. IFF was a device that sent out a signal that told you whether you were friendly or anyway. If you hadn't got it on, everybody fired at you. And they told us there were gliders in this area, so for heaven's sake, don't stray into that area. There'll be Halifaxes flying above you, and by the time they'd finished, we knew that it was something big. They'd fitted our aircraft with a cine camera, and we were due to take pictures as we went over. And it was the naval gun emplacements at the tip of the Cherbourg Peninsula. Now, our job was to put them out of action so they couldn't impede the landing craft. Although they didn't tell us that, they just told it was an important naval guns that we'd got to put out of action. And it was just approaching dawn as we came, but it was still...
Is that dawn on the 6th?
Yes, on the morning of D-Day.
What about when you're flying over? Did you have any trouble with the American warships or the warships in general firing at you?
Yes, they fired. They fire at anything.
Were they anywhere near?
No. We were still...
Were they US warships, or do you not know, really? They were just warships.
It was the US more than anything. They always fired, whether he was flashing the right signals or not.
And did they get anywhere near you?
No, because we were on the course we were supposed to be on, and they were probably firing at other aircraft that were not so meticulous. But we couldn't see much because it was dark, but as the sky lightened, we flew in and bombed.
Now, did you hit them? I mean, do you know what the results
were? Yes, we wiped out that gun emplacement. But the cine cameras didn't work. It was too dark for our cameras to work. But as we turned round then, the sky, which had been pretty overcast, there were breaks in the cloud, and we saw all these hundreds and hundreds of landing craft making their way to the beaches. And then we knew for sure it was the invasion.
Was it a fairly imposing sight?
It was, to see all these ships with the bigger ships they'd landed from lying offshore, and these coming in towards the beach. By that time, of course, we were not over the beach, so we couldn't actually see the beach.
Now, that night, I believe, you had a bit of a celebration in the pub. Tell us that story, because it's quite interesting how people react.
Yes. We were not flying. So, of course, as soon as we knew we weren't going to fly that night, because we'd been that morning, we dashed off to Nottingham. Not Jack, because he was busy writing reports. By that time, he was the flight leader, and so he had a lot of office work to do. And so we went to Nottingham, went down to our pub, where we're the favourite crew, and the news came on, and they put it on the loudspeaker about this morning, you know, our troops landed on the continent and everything. They said, "Why? What happened to you boys?" So we were there. It's emotional now even to think of it. The pints came over.
They all bought you drinks.
Yes, it was quite a night.
Now, what happened next then? After that, there seemed to be a lot of French targets.
They were mainly flying bomb sites, because at that time the V-bombs and the flying bombs had started raiding. And although the fighters did their best over Kent and the Akak over Kent, we were told to go and bomb the targets. They were very difficult targets to bomb, because you were trying to hit a 100-yard long runway, few yards wide, surrounded by AKAK guns, because a small target that can practically create a curtain of fire that you have to fly through in order to bomb. And so although there were short trips, which meant short time in the air out there and back, bomb and back, they were very dangerous trips, and we did lose bombers to those.
Did you do any raids in support of the army, on tactical German troop concentrations?
Yes, the big support raid was at Caen, which the Germans were holding in spite of bombing and things, and the army was held up just short of Caen, and we were asked to clear a way for all them. And it was a daylight raid. And because about this time we were flying some daylight raids. And when we knew we were going to Caen in daylight on a 1,000 bomber raid, the squadron navigation officer decided he wanted to come with us. The squadron bombing officer decided he wanted to come with us. And so we got these high ranking passengers. And it was quite a sight to see 1,000 bombers assembled and flying over the channel, and on this beautiful day. And then we bombed, and there wasn't a lot of opposition. I think previous raids had silenced a lot of the opposition, but we pretty well flattened Caen, absolutely flattened it. So much so that we heard afterwards that the army still had a job getting through it because of all the rubble. It was just piles of rubble. But on the way back, the navigation officer decided he wanted to have a go at navigating back So I had to be a passenger while he sat in my seat and navigated us back.
The next, there's a couple more raids. That raid, by the way, was on the 18th of July. I'm just picking, putting the dates yes. in so people can see where it was. And there was a big army attack there.
Yes.
Now, what about on the 25th of July, you target the St. Cyr Military Academy.
Oh, that.
There's a panzer depot in Paris. And that seems to have been nearly a disaster. Can you tell that story?
That was the nearest we ever came to getting shot down. Except for an incident landing at our own aerodrome once. But it was daylight, a daylight raid. Beautiful June evening. We hadn't been flying in daylight very long. And so we started off, trying to fly in VIX of 3, which soon disintegrated. So we were really just a stream. We'd been told there were two big flak areas halfway there to Paris. And sure enough, they opened up as soon as we got anywhere near. And we got hit on the way in.
Or by? That's right.
By a flak burst just underneath the aircraft. And I was standing up in the Astrodome having a look out, and I could see just a flume of blue smoke coming out of one of the starboard engines. And then it gradually thickened until the clouds coming out, and all of a sudden flames pouring out, which was frightening. And the pilot pressed, or the engineer pressed the button that puts foam into the engine. So it stops. Put the fire out, but of course you can't use that engine. So we went on three engines, again encountered the heavy defences around Paris, and as we banked to bomb the target, I could saw the Eiffel Tower underneath. My first time I'd ever seen the Eiffel Tower in Paris stretching out underneath on this very nice evening. And we bombed the academy. I think it was in a training school for Panzer or something like that. I've forgotten now what it was for, but anyway, it was military, very important to them. And flew back then. And of course, by that time, we'd been hit again over the target by a stray bullet that had made the starboard inner engine run rough. The engineer was keeping it going as long as he could, but it was dicey, shaky. We didn't know whether it would last out, so we couldn't maintain the required speed. Then we saw the rest of the squadron pulling away from us gradually, because that's the thing about daylight, you can see everything. And as they disappeared, two Messerschmitts came over the horizon towards us. And that really sent my heart down into my boots. I thought, how can we manoeuvre with 2.5 engines? And the gunners were giving a steady course of directions to Jack as they neared. And three Spitfires arrived. And we think somebody had radioed back that V Victor was in trouble and was lagging. And they sent these Spitfires deliberately to look for us. And they chased the Messerschmitts, ME-109s, I think they were. They vanished out of sight, and then the Spitfires came back, wagging their wings, and they fell in each side of us, and escorted us right back to England and our drone.
But you'd been very lucky that time.
We had been very lucky, because they wouldn't let us land at Aldrome, because they didn't want us to crash on the runway and stop any other late aircraft from landing. So we diverted to Waddington, which was our base station, which had landed all their aircraft. And the green lights wouldn't come on the undercart, so we didn't know whether it had been hit and whether they'd locked or not. Sometimes they would lock, but the lights wouldn't be on. And of course, control tower knew that we had been hit and were in trouble. And as we came in over the end of the runway, fire engines and ambulances started up and kept pace with us right down the runway. But we landed, and the undercarriage didn't buckle, so we landed okay. And the group captain himself, the base commander, came out in his car and congratulated us as we landed and welcomed us. And we said to the wireless op said to mid-upper, don't careful how you climb down, there's a big hole underneath you. And there was a hole in the fuselage. And
it was pretty badly damaged.
The whole aircraft was badly shot up, yes. And in fact, we couldn't take it with us on the next trip because we had to fly a replacement.
Did that affect your nerves at all afterwards? You know, when you thought about what had happened?
I can't remember. You're young and fatalistic. You know, if it's going to get you, it's going. Perhaps that was the one that was supposed to get us, and the next one won't. So we went and got drunk, as we did every night. I think that was the way we kept going.
Can I ask you about drinking habits? I mean, how much were you drinking? What sort of level of drinking are we talking about? I mean, because, you know, drinking depends on the person. I mean, three pints can be a lot to some people, and 8 pints is a lot.
We were drinking 5 to 6 pints.
Which is night. Heavy social drinking.
Heavy.
But it's not that
no.
Bad. You know?
No. I mean, it never got... I could tell when I'd had enough. I used to stand on the top of the stove in the middle of the hut and recite Shakespeare.
And where would you drink? In the science mess or in the pubs?
In the pubs, mostly.
What were the pubs like when you went drinking in them?
Full, mostly of aircrew. And we're no novelty in Lincoln, as we were in Nottingham. I mean, we're a novelty in Nottingham, and quite celebrities. And they look forward to seeing us every night. I realise now...
You'd go to Nottingham a lot then?
A lot, yes.
So a lot of drunken driving then? It wasn't illegal then? I'm not saying
no, it wasn't illegal.
But you would drink and drive, obviously.
Well, we didn't drive on... We weren't drunk on the way there. And by morning, on the way back, you know...
So you'd stay overnight?
Stay overnight.
You always stayed overnight at your mother's, so...
Yes.
Your parents, so...
Yes, and...
So you'd go there as much as you went to Lincoln, if not more, from the sound of it?
Yes, more often, yes. And that was the advantage of...
And which pubs would you drink in Nottingham? I mean, were there any particular ones you went to?
The Robin Hood was the nearest, but our favourite was the Sherwood Inn, just a little bit further down, only about 300 yards from... where we stay, my home. And my father and mum were regulars there. So was my old headmaster. He was in the ATC, in the territorials, Captain Shaw, he was by that time. And he sat there and when he used to go in. And we used to sing these ribald songs. And they didn't mind. They were just, you know, happy to have us there. But I realised now what a strain it must have been on my mother and anybody that cared about us. Because knowing that we'd been flying the night before, we'd been there, if we weren't there the next night, we're probably flying again and might never come back. She must have been very, very... She never showed it. She was always very... And Paddy and Butch were very good at making friends with the ugliest, fattest waffs in the cookhouse, who were flattered by their attentions. And when they came to Nottingham, they'd go round the cookhouse door and they'd be given packets of lard and butter, bacon and stuff, which helped my mother with the rations for us. But she went out without a lot.
Now, what about the sergeant's mess? What did that offer you? You don't seem to have gone there much, but what was it like?
Well, they're just armchairs round and a bar, but we hardly ever went.
Why not?
Because we'd rather go to Nottingham. And
it was more fun.
It was more fun. We got all the girlfriends there and the dancers in Nottingham, the Palladie dance. Nowadays, you can't believe what it's like to have 2,000 people on the dance floor. So densely packed that you had to sort of wait with your partner at the side and force your way into a little gap before you went round with the stream. And if you tripped over, you couldn't fall down because there were too many people all round you.
And what did they have bars in the dance halls?
Oh, yes, and we drank there.
And how was it all sorted out, who danced with who? I mean, because these things don't happen now, you know, different, isn't it?
No, well, a man could ask any girl to dance. And, of course, I danced with Joan a lot because we used to take her with us, and sometimes we'd take my sister. But Paddy and Butch were never short of anyone to dance with. In fact, they used to ask them beforehand, "Do you?" And if they said no, they'd left them and went to somebody else. And they generally ended up with somebody that they could take home and who would. They were quite characters. And I was such an innocent young man, really, that it was an eye-opener for me.
Now, would it be a live band at the...
Yes, there were the big bands. I can't remember the names now of them.
What sort of music was it? The sort of big band, Glenn Miller or the British style? Because there's different styles of dance music, aren't there?
They were both, depending on the bands that were performing at that particular place.
Was there ever any trouble in the dance halls? Because women, men, you know.
I never saw any. In fact, you know, you see some of these films like Yanks and the fights that broke out. We and the Americans got on very well. And the Poles and everybody, we were happy. There were plenty of girls. Nottingham, of course, had an abundance of girls. There was Players' Cigarette Factory employing women. Rally bikes, boots, laboratories and factories. So all these girls were spare, and a lot of them, even if they weren't spare, the men were called up, and so there were a lot of talent.
Now, you decided you were quite close to Joan, and
yes.
She would become your first wife, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, that's right.
You decided not to get married. Now, we sort of glided over that, but now you're... Why? Because some people decided to get married simply because then they'd get the allowance if they were killed and all the rest of it. On the other hand, they'd be married to someone who might be dead.
Yeah.
What did you feel about it?
Well, I thought it wouldn't be fair to make a widow of somebody so young and pretty as Joan. It was that, really. I thought, when I finish, then I'll get married. I was still in the Air Force when I did get married in 1945. And then, of course, by that time I was commissioned, and so I got a very handsome marriage allowance. And,
but until then, you just weren't prepared to risk it?
No, no.
Now, So the sergeant's mess, we've gone back to the sergeant's mess. What, so did you just never go into it at all, or were you fed there and things like that?
We're fed there. We had our meals there.
And what sort of food would you get, generally? I know that not the crew meals, I mean the normal food.
I can't remember much about... I mean, food was food. You know, meat, two veg.
Not soup, something you remember.
Not something I remember. Soup to start, and then roly-poly pudding or stodge as a pudding.
But that's where you'd eat, and there was enough of it.
There was enough, plenty of food, yes.
Now, how did you get on with the ground crew? Because, you know, they're very important to air crew, whether they know it or not. I wondered how, whether you appreciated it.
We got on very well with our own ground crew. You had a sergeant who was assigned to the dispersal with both planes on, and then you got a separate corporal for each plane with his fitters and riggers, and they worked together, and they would work their socks off to make sure the aircraft was repaired and everything ready to go the next night. And they shouted at us if we got it bent, as they say. And we took them for a drink occasionally. And the pilot, more than us, because, you know, he would be reporting all the technical things, the engineer. But, yes, we were made friends with the ground crew.
And were you happy with the work they did? I mean... You know, I mean, did you think they took their responsibilities seriously to you?
They did, yes. Because we were their crew. And if we went west, they'd lost their crew and their aircraft. And so, yes, they were...
And did things generally work? I mean, you said a couple of times, you know, I mean, the bombing helm hung up.
Yeah.
But did things generally perform all right on your aircraft, even though it had been in a lot of operations?
Yes, it did. Because the you know, you got the flight tests during the daytime, and that still left time for anything to be put right before we went out in the evening, and they were very good at their work, or at least our particular ground crew were.